If you wish to become a complete and wise leader, you must embrace a larger view of the Force.
And welcome, everyone. My name is DeVore, and you are listening to episode 12 of A Larger View of the Force, a Star Wars podcast. A reminder, as always, check out the earlier episodes of the show if you're new here, and make sure to subscribe to keep up with new episodes of the show as they come out. Today, for the first show of 2021, I'll be taking a look back at the second season of The Mandalorian. This is actually going to be the first of two back-to-back Mandalorian-themed episodes for the month of January, and I'll have more to say about the second one at the end of the show. Now, no doubt lots of Star Wars podcasts are or will be doing these sorts of recaps, so when I decided on this as an episode topic, I was committed even more than usual to doing something that would be a larger view of the Force-y. So, I'm not going to be going through the season episode by episode and recapping all of the various story beats. Instead, I want to take a bigger picture view, and I want to look at The Mandalorian Season 2 through the lens of Star Wars storytelling, and to talk about how the show incorporated some of the core narrative building blocks of the Star Wars franchise. So to that end, I'm going to divide this discussion of Season 2 of The Mandalorian into four parts, and each of those parts is going to be focused on one particular theme or motif in Star Wars storytelling. And those four themes are going to be stepping into a larger world, parents and children, confronting darkness, and truths from a certain point of view. So let's get into the first of those, stepping into a larger world. Now, I would make the case that this is as close to a universal in Star Wars storytelling as possible. I think it is more universal even than something like hope or family. A really key element to a Star Wars hero's journey, and we see this time and again, is that their story starts out small and then gets bigger. We see this in the saga films with Anakin, Luke, and Rey. We see this in Clone Wars with Ahsoka. We see this in Rebels with Ezra. We see this in Poe Dameron Freefall. We see this in Lost Stars. It's everywhere. The Mandalorian Season 2 has come under fire, at least in some corners, for falling victim to what some people call small universe syndrome. And this is particularly in reference to all the various cameos that we get in Season 2. The crux of this argument is that, well, Din is going on this journey, he's traversing the galaxy, and it just so happens that he's running into all of these big-name characters that we've met at other points in the franchise, and that this it has the effect of making the world of Star Wars in the galaxy smaller. Now, I would make the case that, on the contrary, I think it is the cameos that we get, the introduction of characters like Bo-Katan and Ahsoka and even a Cobb Vanth, that those are precisely the things that are making the story and the world of The Mandalorian bigger. So what we see over the course of the first two seasons is that Din's quest starts off as small. So his first mandate is he's got to get Grogu to the Imperial Remnant on Navarro, and then in the second season, his quest is he's got to get Grogu to the Jedi. And in the course of fulfilling those quests, he is intersecting with these other stories and these other struggles that are unfolding in the galaxy at the same time. And so I would compare Din and the Mandalorian to what we see in Lord of the Rings. So what happens in Lord of the Rings? Well, Frodo is given this quest that he has to take the One Ring to Mordor to destroy it. And over the course of his journey, he is intersecting with all of these other characters and all of these other developments that are taking place in Middle Earth. So he crosses paths with Aragorn, what Aragorn is up to. He crosses paths with the elves and the elves migrating out of Middle Earth. The quest ends up intertwining with the politics of Rohan and Gondor and what's going on with men and their changing place in the world of Middle-earth. So I think in the same way that in Lord of the Rings, you have this quest that starts out very small and then it gets bigger and bigger over the course of the story, I think the same thing is happening in The Mandalorian. Din's story starts out small. That's where we see him in season one. But now as he's running into all of these other major players, his story and his world is getting bigger. And I've made this comparison on Twitter a couple times, but I think like Din is sort of the Forrest Gump of Star Wars. He's sort of inadvertently walking through all of these major galactic events without really meaning to, and he has really no interest in entangling himself with any of them. He just wants to fulfill this mission of getting Grogu to the Jedi. And so what we've seen, even just in these first two seasons, we've seen Din intersecting with, among other things, the rise of the First Order, the politics of the New Republic. We get a little bit of that in season two. The rebuilding of the Jedi, we get that at the very end with Luke, the hunt for Thrawn that we see in the Ahsoka episode, and then the retaking of Mandalore with Bo-Katan and what she's up to. Now, back a couple episodes ago when I did my Rebels episode with Forced Host, if you haven't listened to the Rebels episode I did with Forced Host, go listen to the Rebels episode I did with Forced Host. And in that episode, I brought up Rebels as a model for how The Mandalorian could incorporate cameos into the show. That episode came out right before season two of The Mandalorian started. And you know what we see in Star Wars Rebels is you get a whole bunch of characters from the original trilogy, from Clone Wars that come into the show. But none of those really take the focus off of the main cast of characters, the crew of the Ghost that we get in Rebels. Instead, those cameos have the function of really allowing us to flesh out our main cast and allowing them to be put in these new and different situations and challenging them and allowing them to grow and develop. And I would make the case that, so far at least, The Mandalorian has held to that model. I think it has really stuck pretty well to the Rebels template. I don't really think that, by and large, the cameos that we have gotten have really distracted us from Din and his journey and his relationship to Grogu. There's some people who have made the case that Luke kind of detracts a little bit at the very end. I'll address that more towards the end of the show. Rather than taking away focus from Din, I think that a lot of the characters that we meet, and particularly a lot of the recurring characters that we meet in Mandalorian Season 2, have functioned as mirrors for Din, in which Din was able to see himself and to be challenged on his worldview and of his own perspective widened. So I think a lot of these characters in Season 2 have been the means by which Din has stepped into this larger world. So I want to talk about some of those instances that we get in Season 2, starting with Cobb Vanth, who we meet in the season two opener. So Din is on Tatooine looking for a Mandalorian. He goes to Mos Pelgo where he finds Cobb Vanth. He's wearing the Mandalorian armor. And much to Din's chagrin, he comes to discover that Cobb Vanth is not in fact a Mandalorian. As we've seen in that episode, Din has a very strong reaction to Cobb removing his helmet. And once he learns that Cobb isn't actually a Mandalorian, he immediately demands that Cobb hand the armor back over to him, and things get very tense, and it looks like the two of them are about to brawl over the armor. And in the course of that initial interaction, Cobb Vanth says something that I think is really interesting and really important, and I think when you consider it in the arc of the whole of the second season, I think has a lot more meaning and significance than it did even when Cobb Vanth said it initially. So Cobb Vanth tells Din this, quote, "I've never met a real Mandalorian. Heard stories. I know you're good at killing, and probably none too happy to see me wearing this hardware. So I figure only one of us walking out of here. But then I see the little guy, and I think maybe I pegged you wrong." That line, I think, has a lot of importance when we think about it over the course of the journey that Din takes in the second season. Cobb Vanth is really the first person that Din meets in his quest, who points out to him that his relationship, his bond to Grogu, has changed him at a kind of core elemental level. because he mentions that line, like he sees Din and he initially thinks that Din is a kind of stereotypical cold-blooded Mandalorian. And that is in fact how we meet Din all the way back in the season one opener when he's in that cantina and he's going for the bounty on the Mithral. We meet him as a very stereotypical Mandalorian. But then once he gets the kid, once he gets Grogu and he's going on this journey with Grogu, he is starting to change who he is. And Cobb Vanth is really the first person to tell us that. And so Cobb Vanth is important because he really starts this process of challenging both how Din is perceived and how Din perceives himself. And that's going to have ripple effects and ramifications over the course of the second season, as we'll see. So their initial standoff is interrupted by the arrival of the Krayt Dragon coming through Mos Pelgo. And the real crux of the plot of that first episode is about this mission to kill the Krayt Dragon. And if Din succeeds in that, in exchange, Cobb Vanth agrees to hand over the Mandalorian armor back to Din. And so what we see in that first episode is that the Krayt Dragon mission forces cooperation between these two historically antagonistic groups, between, on the one hand, the Tusken Raiders, and then on the other hand, the villagers of Mos Pelgo. And so that becomes the first of a motif in season two, which is forging alliances between different people and different groups who have traditionally been at odds and have traditionally not seen eye to eye. And again, this is something that we're going to see repeated at multiple points in the second season. Now, at the end of the episode, when the mission is successful and the Krayt Dragon is slain, we see at that point both the growth that Din has been on just in the course of that one episode, but also some of the limitations and where he still has to go. So on the one hand, Din comes to see Cobb Vanth in a more positive light. He comes to recognize Cobb Vanth as a formidable warrior and as an honorable man, which is a big change from the beginning of the episode where he treats Cobb Vanth very antagonistically. Crucially, however, that recognition does not translate into earning Cobb Vanth the armor. It's not as if Din suddenly recognizes Cobb Vanth as a Mandalorian or something like that, or looks at Cobb Vanth and says, hey, you know what? You're a good fighter. You're a good man. Keep that armor. It's yours. You've earned it. He still walks away with the Boba Fett armor. So Din is still, even though his perspective is starting to open up, he's still very much locked into his preconceived worldview. And what we'll see as we get later on in the episode and we talk about events that happen later on in the season, by the time we get the introduction of Boba Fett, he's going to have a different attitude towards that armor and to whom it rightfully belongs. But before we get there, we got to get to talk about some other cast of characters, such as Frog Lady. So Frog Lady, we meet in the second episode. Din agrees to bring her to the planet of Trask so that she can get her eggs fertilized, and in exchange, she will offer him information about where to find other Mandalorians. And what we see in the course of that episode, particularly after the Razor Crest crashes, is that Frog Lady, much like Cobb Vanth, becomes this figure that kind of challenges Din on his Mandalorian creed. So once they're crash landed on the ice planet, Din kind of tries to slow walk the repairs. Frog Lady is particularly adamant about getting the ship up and running as fast as possible because she's got to get these eggs fertilized within a certain window of time. And she ends up hijacking the remains of the droid Zero so that she can communicate to him in basic. And when she talks to him, she says, quote, "I thought honoring one's word was a part of the Mandalorian code. I guess those are just stories for children." So she's really pressing Din on his beliefs and on his identity and challenging him to live up to his word and to the Mandalorian creed. So once again there, as with Cobb Vanth, Din is being forced to kind of confront his own identity and his own values and his own worldview. All of that, however, pales in comparison to what happens when Din meets Bo-Katan. So Din is successful in getting Frog Lady to the planet of Trask. Her husband, Frog Man, points her to some Quarren who say that they can bring Din to some Mandalorians. It turns out to be a trap. They try to entrap him in order to get his Beskar armor, and Din is ultimately rescued by Bo-Katan, Koska Reeves, and Axe Wolves. And what happens here and why the Aerys is such an important inflection point in Din's story is that Bo-Katan is really the first serious challenge to Din's conception of the Way. And I think I would make the case, even when considered in the broad arc of season two, I think she is still remains the biggest challenge and challenger to Din's own understanding of his own identity and Mandalorian identity. So what we see in that episode is after the trio rescues Din, they immediately proceed to remove their helmets, and Din, as he did with Cobb Vanth, has a very negative reaction to that. Now, as you saw in the case of Cobb Vanth took off the helmet, but he never claimed to be a Mandalorian. He made no pretense to belonging to this group of people. Bo-Katan, however, is a Mandalorian, so that's what makes her such a potent challenge to Din. And as I mentioned, as we see in the episode, Din has a very negative reaction when she and the Mandalorians take off their helmets. So he immediately, as he does with Cobb Vanth, he questions them. He says, "Where did you get that armor?" Bo-Katan responds, "This armor has been in my family for three generations," an important line that I'm actually going to come back to in a few minutes. Din responds to that, "You do not cover your face. You are not a Mandalorian." And it is at that that Bo-Katan reveals to Din that he, in fact, belonged to a cult called the Children of the Watch that adhered to a very narrow, strict, doctrinaire view of Mandalorian heritage and identity and cultural values. And Din, to that, he responds, "There is only one way, the way of the Mandalore," and he promptly rocketeers off with Grogu. So you see there Din getting challenged. He thought that his way was the way, and then you've got Bo-Katan, another Mandalorian, telling him, "Oh no, dude, you were raised in this weird little group that had this very specific, very narrow, and very limited view of what it meant to be a Mandalorian." And Din initially can't kind of cognitively process that. He just immediately goes into denial and leaves. And something similar happens a little bit later on in the episode when Bo-Katan reunites with him, and they're at the bar just before they go on the mission to take the Gazanti cruiser. She pushes back when Din insists that Mandalore is cursed when she tells him about their plan to retake Mandalore, and then she tells him, "Don't believe everything you hear." So Bo-Katan is really pushing Din to have a larger view and a larger understanding of what and who a Mandalorian is. And he is coming to understand that the principles that he was taught and that he grew up with were not the views that all Mandalorians everywhere adhered to. And so that is going to be particularly important for him later on in the story. The next character that we meet in the course of season two that really offers Din some greater insight into himself is Ahsoka Tano in The Jedi. Now, I think, just as like a small point of criticism, I think The Jedi could have done more to flesh out Ahsoka as a mirror character to Din. I don't think it did much work in that regard. I think that, in particular, I think that the episode could have built on that reveal that we get in the Aerys about Din having belonged to this cult by drawing out some of the similarities between Din and Ahsoka's backstories. I think we could have gotten a scene where Din and Ahsoka are kind of commiserating about their backgrounds and their childhoods and the fact that they were both taken as children and that they were raised in these very doctrinaire groups and that they were kind of sheltered and isolated from larger society. Nonetheless, even though it doesn't do that work, I think that Ahsoka does still offer some valuable insights to Din, particularly as regards his relationship to Grogu, which I'll talk about in a few minutes when I get to parents and children. And I think much as with the Tusken Raiders and the Mos Pelgo villagers uniting in the first episode to take out the Krayt Dragon, I think what we also see in The Jedi is we see this alliance being forged between these two historically antagonistic groups. You know, Din has that line where he says, a Mandalorian and a Jedi, they'll never see it coming. Of course, he doesn't know about Rebels and Clone Wars and all that. But the Jedi and the Mandalorians have historically been at odds, but they're coming together because they've got this common enemy. In this case, it was Morgan Elsbeth. So again, continuing that motif that we see in season two of the of forging these alliances between these groups and these people who have different views or are at odds for one reason or another. Then a couple episodes down the road, we get the reintroduction back into the story of the character of Boba Fett. And I think Boba Fett is really interesting because I think Boba Fett is this marker that really demonstrates how much Din has evolved over the course of the season, particularly when we compare the way that Din deals with Boba Fett versus the way he deals with Bo-Katan and the way that he dealt with Cobb Vanth. So when Din first meets Boba on Tython in the tragedy, the interaction between the two of them unfolds much as it did with Bo-Katan. So when Boba rolls up and demands that Din hand over his armor, Din asks him, are you a Mandalorian? Did you swear the creed? He is running through that checklist the same way that he did with Bo-Katan, the same way that he did with Cobb Vanth, on trying to establish Boba's credentials as a Mandalorian. And Boba, much like Cobb Vanth, is not making any claim to Mandalorian heritage or identity. He even overtly says at one point, I offer my allegiance to no one. Instead, his claim on the armor rests solely on the fact that it belonged to his father, and that's why he wants it back. And what we see at the end of the episode, when Boba does eventually first take his armor back and then is ultimately granted to him by Din, is we see in that moment the way that Din's own perspective has gotten wider and has started to shift. So at the end of that episode, Boba pulls up that chain code that he's got in his armor, where he shows that his father Jango was a foundling and had fought in the Mandalorian Civil Wars. And upon learning that, Din acknowledges that the armor does rightfully belong to him. Now, this is important because it is an important point of contrast to how he deals with Bo-Katan and the Heiress. Bo-Katan also makes a familial claim to the armor. She tells Din, this armor has been in my family for three generations. But that just goes right over Din's head. He does not recognize or acknowledge that in any way or use that as any basis for saying that Bo-Katan is in fact a true Mandalorian. Versus when we look in the case of Boba Fett. In the case of Boba Fett, he accepts the familial claim. Boba pulls up the hologram and says, hey, look, this belonged to my father, Jango. And Din is like, oh, okay, then I guess the armor is yours. So I think that is an important point of evidence showing Din's evolution over the course of the season. He recognizes Boba's ownership of the armor, despite the fact that Boba doesn't say he's a Mandalorian, he doesn't swear the creed, and he doesn't even keep his helmet on. But nonetheless, Din is saying that Boba has this rightful claim to the armor. So I think that's really, really important, and that is really showing how much Din has changed. Also, an aside, because we're talking about Boba Fett, and of course we'll talk more about Boba Fett later on, I wanted to bring this up in the context of cameos. For me, the most mind-blowing, the most shocking cameo in The Mandalorian is not actually any of the characters. It's not Boba Fett, it's not Bo-Katan, it's not Ahsoka. It's Slave One. When Slave One shows up in the tragedy, I was totally shocked. I did not think that we were going to get Slave One in The Mandalorian. Even when we got that reveal at the end of The Marshal where we saw that Boba Fett was still alive, I still didn't think that we were going to get Slave One. I figured, well, the reason that he's on Tatooine is because he doesn't have Slave One anymore. So, like, that was totally shocking, totally unexpected. If you had told me a year ago that Boba Fett was going to show up in The Mandalorian, I'd have been like, eh, I guess that's plausible. Sure, like, that could happen. If you had told me Slave One was going to be in The Mandalorian, I'd have been like, no way. Like, that's not happening. It's not possible. I never thought that we were going to get live-action Slave One again. So, seeing that ship, seeing Din on Slave One, seeing it launch that seismic charge and the Believer, unbelievable. Not in my wildest dreams did I think we were going to get Slave One back. So, like, that was a real, real treat for me for this season. So, after Boba Fett, in the following episode, The Tragedy, which I just referenced, we get the return of a recurring character from Season 1, and that is Miggs Mayfeld. And Miggs, much like all these other characters that we've been talking about, like a Cobb Vanth, like a Frog Lady, like a Bo-Katan, like a Boba, Miggs is also pushing Din, albeit much more overtly than the other do, on his worldview and his perspective and on the nature of his creed. So they have that conversation when they're on the Rhydonium transport going to the Imperial encampment. Miggs tells him at one point, he says, quote, "Seems to me like your rules start to change when you get desperate. I mean, look at you. You said you couldn't take off your helmet, and now you got a stormtrooper one on. So what's the rule? Is it you can't take off your Mando helmet, or you can't show your face? Because there is a difference. Look, I'm just saying, we're all the same. Everybody's got their line they don't cross until things get messy." So I think that's really important, really pushing Din on saying, like, what is the actual rule? And what is the justification for your views? Like, what are they grounded in? What are they rooted in? And Din, very tellingly, doesn't respond to Miggs in the context of the conversation. He just keeps, like, looking forward. He's not at all acknowledging any of this. Much in the same way as with Bo-Katan, he's kind of going through this denial where he's just not allowing himself to really process this information that contradicts his worldview. And I remember watching that episode for the first time, and when Miggs brings up all that stuff about, like, what is the actual rules about the helmet, I thought about a line from Mark Twain. I think it's in Tom Sawyer, where he says something to the effect of, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing here, he says that the less there is to justify, like, a tradition or a custom, the harder it is to get rid of it. And I think you kind of see that illustrated with Din, where Din doesn't really have any answers to Miggs's questions about what are the actual rules, what are these rules grounded or based in, and instead he just kind of ignores them and persists. So I think that's really interesting. And then, of course, the other reason that that episode is really important is we see Din, in order to get a hold of Gideon's coordinates, in order to be able to go rescue Grogu, is he breaks his creed in a major way by removing his helmet in the presence of other people. So that is a big point of evolution for Din, where he starts softening on a lot of these rules, even if when we see him earlier on in the episode, like, he doesn't seem to be all that interested in any kind of questioning or challenges to his views. He does ultimately come around to bending his own rules, much in the way that Meg sort of says about, like, well, all of us, we're all willing to bend our rules when the going gets tough. So that's really important. So all of these characters that we meet over the course of The Mandalorian Season 2, some of them like Frog Lady New, but most of them recurring, whether it's somebody like Mayfeld from season one, or these recurring characters from other parts of the franchise, an Ahsoka, a Boba, a Bo-Katan, all of them are pushing Din out of his comfort zone and are really facilitating Din taking that step into a larger world and recognizing that there is more to the galaxy, there is more to being a Mandalorian than just following this one narrow way that he was raised in. And so in that aspect, I think Mandalorian Season 2 fits squarely within the tradition of Star Wars storytelling, of having our hero taking the step into a larger world and having his worldview grow and expand. Moving on now to the second theme or motif, and that is parents and children. Now, I want to make a distinction here. I'm talking specifically about this as something separate from the motif of family in Star Wars. Not all stories about family in Star Wars are about parents and children. So if you look, for example, at all the big threes in the trilogy, so Anakin, Obi-Wan, Padme, Han, Luke, Leia, Rey, Finn, Poe, those are all instances of family, particularly found family, but they're not instances of relations between parents and children. In Rebels, we get a kind of hybrid example. We do get stories that are about parents and children, particularly if you look at, like, Kanan and Ezra, but then we also get a story about family, like this whole ghost crew is a kind of found family. So I'm really sort of narrowing in on this one particular type of family dynamic that we get, which is about between parents and children. And that is a story that we get at multiple points in the Star Wars franchise. We see it between Vader and Luke, we see it between Han and Leia and Ben Solo, and then, as I mentioned, between Kanan and Ezra on Rebels. And we see it also in The Mandalorian between Din and Grogu. And that relationship, that parent-child relationship, starts to really grow and blossom over the course of the second season. So if you think about where season one ended, when Din was having the conversation with the armorer on Nevarro, there the armorer tells him, quote, "By creed, until it," meaning Grogu, "is of age or reunited with its own kind, you are as its father." So she's the first, she sort of establishes this notion of Din occupying this kind of parental position vis-a-vis Grogu. You are as its father. However, I think as the first half of season two in particular makes clear, that doesn't really sink in with Din. I think over the course of that first half, it's pretty clear that Din does not treat Grogu as a son, but instead he really does treat him as this obligation that he's got to fulfill before going back to business and back to the status quo. He doesn't treat Grogu as this being to whom he has a particularly special bond. It's basically like, okay, we got to find the Jedi so I can drop this kid off and then I can go back to bounty hunting. We see this, I think, particularly in the first episode in The Marshal, where when they're all fighting the crate dragon and Din is going to go on his like Hail Mary move to go into the crate dragon to blow it up from the inside, he basically tells Cobb Vanth to look after Grogu just before he like jetpacks off to the crate dragon. So there in that instance, Din is basically willing to leave Grogu, who is ostensibly his son, you are as its father, as the armorer says. He's willing to leave Grogu with a total stranger if things go south and he dies, without a second thought. So it's very clear then that Din is not treating Grogu as a son. And we see in other instances when he's talking about Grogu and making references to him that he's not really seeing him as a son in that early part of the season. So for instance, in the Eris, he refers to Grogu at one point as my friend when they're in the Mon Calamari bar. And then at the end of the episode, when he's picking him up from the frog people, he analogizes Grogu to a pet. So he's definitely not thinking about acting, treating Grogu like a son. He's not really acting like a father. He's really instead acting more like a steward or a custodian to this kid and looking to drop him off with the people to whom he really belongs. Two interactions, however, start to change this for Din. The first of these is Frog Lady. So I think Frog Lady in this respect, if we think about Frog Lady in the context of this motif of parents and children, I think Frog Lady very much represents a mirror character to the journey that Din is on with Grogu. So Frog Lady, when she, in that moment when she hijacks Zero to be able to talk to Din, she says, quote, "These eggs are the last brood of my life cycle. My husband has risked his life to carve out an existence for us on the only planet that is hospitable to our species. We fought too hard and suffered too much to resign ourselves to the extinction of our family line." What we see in that second episode is that, like Din, Frog Lady is also undertaking a perilous journey for the sake of her children. Also like Din, when we meet Frog Lady in episode 2, she's not a parent yet. She's basically at a midway point. She's got these eggs, but they're unfertilized. So she's not actually a full-fledged mother yet. So she, what we see with her going from episode 2 into episode 3 is that she evolves into being a parent just as Din does. So we meet Frog Lady basically in the same place where we meet Din, which is these two characters who are in this kind of transition point into parenthood and into accepting and embracing all of the responsibilities that come with that. And then we see Frog Lady kind of taking that journey and becoming a mother once that one tadpole hatches. And we are similarly seeing Din on a longer and larger trajectory on this course of evolving and growing into and leaning into parenthood, just as Frog Lady does. That same episode with Frog Lady gave us a subplot that represented the first major point of contention and controversy for The Mandalorian Season 2, which was Grogu eating Frog Lady's eggs. So what we see in that episode, and the reason that a lot of people reacted negatively to that plotline, was that it looked like the show was kind of playing it off as funny, the fact that Grogu kept eating these eggs despite being told not to, even though the episode goes out of its way to underscore how precious and important and rare the eggs were to Frog Lady. So it was almost seeing as though we were having a laugh, or the audience was expected to have a laugh at Frog Lady's expense. But I think that that plot line, looked at in the wider context of season two, again, with that bird's eye view, that 30,000 foot view, I think there's more than humor going on. I do agree that they were kind of trying to have a laugh at Frog Lady's expense, but I think it's more than just this punchline. There's a really good article that got published on Vulture not too long ago, and I'll actually throw a link to it in the episode description because I would really encourage people to go read it, that talks for a big chunk of the article talks about the passenger and about this egg-eating plot. And it makes this really good point that I want to bring up here, which is that the egg-eating subplot really underscores the stakes in raising Grogu properly. So what we see in that episode with Grogu eating these eggs that are really, really important to Frog Lady is that if he's not raised well, if Grogu is not taught the right lessons, if he does not have a proper parent in his life, he has the capacity to cause a lot of harm without necessarily meaning to. He's eating those eggs, not understanding their importance to Frog Lady, not being able to perceive that. And Din, in that course of that episode, is not really properly communicating to Grogu why eating the eggs is bad and why he shouldn't do that. So in that episode, with that plot line, we're really seeing Din struggling in being a parent and fulfilling this father-like role that he has been given. And we're really seeing how far he still needs to go in order to be a true parent, to be a true father to Grogu. So, for instance, when he catches Grogu eating the eggs, you know, he tells him no, like he tells him not to do it, but it's a little half-hearted, and crucially, he's not able to communicate and convey to Grogu the significance of the eggs at the moment. So, I think, so there's a lot going on in that episode. We're seeing the importance and the necessity for Grogu to be raised right and to be taught right. And that if he doesn't do that, if that doesn't happen, if he doesn't have a proper parent figure in his life, then things will go, have the potential to go really, really bad. And in some ways, you could make the case maybe that that's a kind of analogy to Anakin, where like Anakin doesn't really have, particularly after he's taken away from Shmi, he doesn't really have a proper parental figure in his life. And maybe that contributes to him going in the direction that he ultimately does. However, I just knocked it a lot on his parenting skills. I do think that in the next episode in the Heiress, we do see him get a little bit better. So when he goes to drop off Grogu with the frog people just before he goes on the mission with Bo-Katan, he tells Grogu, quote, "You are going to stay here, so I want you to be respectful and mind your manners." So I think there we see Din stepping up a little bit more. Like he's really telling Grogu, you need to behave in a certain way. It's important that you behave in a certain way. He's not just telling like, no, don't do that. He's being a little bit more forceful and putting his foot down. So I think we do see Din taking some of those baby steps into becoming a better parent, even just from episode 2 to episode 3. And I think another thing that we see in that episode is I think we do also get a sense that Grogu does ultimately come to comprehend the significance of the eggs after he sees one of them hatch. So we see him like get very giddy and happy, and then at the end of the episode, we see him wanting to play with the tadpole. Now, for all we know, maybe he just wanted to eat the tadpole, and I'm really, really glad that he didn't eat the tadpole. There was a moment at the end of the episode where I was, like, bracing myself for him to eat the tadpole, and I was just, like, really worried about, like, how Phantom was going to blow up if he ate the tadpole. But I think we do see him getting a better understanding than he did when they were just eggs about why the eggs were important. I think there is a bit of evolution there for Grogu as well as for Din. And I think to just hop back to the passenger for a moment, I think the passenger also shows us the bond between Din and Grogu deepening. For instance, we see, you know, Grogu talking a lot to Din more. It's still in the kind of baby babble, but he is trying to communicate more overtly to Din than he has really to any other point in the show so far. But just as how Bo-Katan and the Heiress was the turning point, I think, for Din in his understanding of what it means to be a Mandalorian, I think that the episode The Jedi is the true turning point for Din in terms of his understanding of his relationship to Grogu and him making that psychological leap into understanding his role and his responsibility as a father to Grogu. And I think the episode and Ahsoka do that in a couple different ways. So the first is that Ahsoka gives Din Grogu's name. And we get to see Grogu reacting when he hears Din say his name. So I think that is a really kind of important moment of intimacy. Because now it's not just the kid. He actually has a name. And so that kind of facilitates the two of them bonding and becoming closer. Now that Din actually has a name for him. Additionally, Ahsoka underscores the depth of attachment that exists between the two of them. So when Ahsoka kind of evaluates Grogu's abilities, she tells Din, quote, "He's formed a strong attachment to you. I cannot train him." And then Din responds, "What? Why not? You've seen what he can do." To which Ahsoka replies, "His attachment to you makes him vulnerable to his fears, his anger. All the more reason to train him," Din says. And then Ahsoka responds, "No, I've seen what such feeling can do to a fully trained Jedi Knight, to the best of us. I will not start this child down that path. Better to let his abilities fade." In the aftermath of that episode, there were a lot of people who interpreted that exchange between Din and Ahsoka and her talking about Grogu's attachment to Din and how it was this kind of impediment to him being trained as a Jedi. A lot of people interpreted this as Ahsoka embracing old Jedi views about how attachments were bad. But I don't think that's the case. I don't think this is an instance of Ahsoka kind of falling back on the Jedi status quo necessarily. And the reason I don't think so is that, on the one hand, Ahsoka is recognizing Grogu's attachment to Din in the moment. She's saying he's got a strong bond to you. But crucially, she's also respecting that attachment and that bond. And that is a real contrast that we see, particularly if we put Grogu next to Anakin. So when we see Anakin in The Phantom Menace and he's on Coruscant and he's getting interrogated by the Jedi Council in that moment know about Anakin's attachments. You get that Ki Adi Mundi line, "Your thoughts dwell on your mother." So they know Anakin's got strong bonds, particularly to his mother, but they persist in training Anakin anyway. They go full steam ahead, basically banking on having those attachments either break down or wear down over time. And then in Revenge of the Sith, in that scene where Anakin goes to Yoda after he's having the nightmares about Padme dying in childbirth, there Yoda counsels Anakin to relinquish attachments. He tells him, "Train yourself to let go of everything you fear to lose." And Ahsoka, largely because of Anakin, she knows the danger of persevering on the Jedi path despite the presence of such attachments. She's seen what can happen if you do that. And so she's warning Din against that. And she's concerned so much so about the possible fallout of continuing Grogu on the Jedi path that she's willing to have Grogu lose his Force abilities rather than break those attachments. Which I do think represents a major point of contrast with the Jedi, where the Jedi were really willing to sacrifice those attachments or trying to tell Anakin to basically get rid of them for the sake of the Jedi path. Ahsoka is recognizing, no, these attachments are important and they need to be preserved. And don't break them, don't try to challenge them for the sake of making him a Jedi. Now, I think it is fair to critique Ahsoka on this point and to say that she is perhaps mistaken in seeing a necessary kind of conflict and tension between Grogu's attachments on the one hand and then him going on the Jedi path on the other. After all, we have, for instance, the model that Star Wars Rebels gives us with Ezra and Kanan, who are very closely bonded to one another and are nonetheless both on the Jedi path, or even Kanan and Hera, where they basically have a romantic relationship and they have a very strong bond and attachment, and nonetheless, Kanan is able to be this exemplary Jedi. So I think on that basis, we can say, well, Ahsoka is wrong to think this, and we can kind of ding her for that. However, at the same time, I would caution against holding her too much against that. Andrew Geha, who hosts the wonderful podcast Outer Rim Reads, go check out that podcast if you haven't already. He has this line that he uses on his show that I really like, where he says that Star Wars characters don't know they're in Star Wars. And I think that applies to Ahsoka in this instance, which is to say that she didn't get to know Ezra and Kanan all that well. She didn't know that Kanan and Hera had this very close bond. So she's really speaking from her own experiences with Anakin. She's coming from that perspective rather than the kind of 30,000 foot view of Star Wars is like, oh, there are these other examples. But she doesn't know those examples that well. She hasn't spent that much time with Ezra and Kanan. And remember, the last time that she's with Ezra in The World Between Worlds, she's telling him to let go of his attachment to Kanan and to not go through the portal to go rescue Kanan. So there's a bit of continuity there between Rebels Ahsoka and Mandalorian Ahsoka. So her real frame of reference is not the kind of omniscient Star Wars view that we have. Her frame of reference is the thing that she knows really well, and that is the path of Anakin. And so that is really informing her views in that regard. We get some nice fatherly moments in this episode. So there's that whole scene where Ahsoka is testing Grogu's force abilities, and she's trying to get him to move the pebble using the force, and he won't do it. And then Din steps in, and he takes out the little silver knob from the Razor Crest, and then Grogu is able to reach out and grab it, and then he has that proud father moment where he's super happy about how his son performed. And then at the end of the episode, just before they part ways, before Din and Grogu head off to Tython, Ahsoka tells Din, quote, "You're like a father to him." This sort of parallels what we get at the end of season one, where the armor tells Din about Grogu, "You are as its father." However, in contrast to that moment, this time it looks like it's actually starting to sink in, both as what we see in the episode The Jedi, and then also what we see subsequently at the beginning of the next episode, The Tragedy, where on their way to Tython, you have that whole opening scene when they're on the Razor Crest and Din keeps saying Grogu, and Grogu keeps reacting, and then he laughs for the first time in the show, and then you have that whole bonding moment where Din is referring to Ahsoka as the nice lady, and then Din does that whole exercise where he holds up the little silver knob again, and Grogu is able to grab it with the force, and there's this moment of frustration with Din where he's realizing that Grogu is becoming too powerful for him, and that he's not going to be able to raise him properly, and that he will in fact need to give him up to the Jedi at a certain point. And you can really tell in that scene that Din doesn't really want to let go of Grogu, that the lesson that he's gotten from Ahsoka about the bond that the two of them have is really starting to sink in. And as I mentioned before, he's starting to make that psychological turn towards really accepting and embracing the fact that he is in fact a father to Grogu, where he really hasn't up to this point. Moving then into the tragedy and talking a little bit more again about Boba Fett, as with what I talked about before with Ahsoka and the Jedi, I think the show could have done a little bit more in this episode to flesh out the parallels between Jango and Boba on the one hand, and then Din and Grogu on the other, because I do think they're kind of mirrored pairs. But even though that work is not done in the show itself, it's still there, and we can still see the ways that both of those father-son pairs are similar. So if we look at, for instance, the father figures in both, Jango on the one hand and Din on the other, both of them were Mandalorian foundlings. They were both taken in by Mandalorians and raised in the Mandalorian way. And then conversely, both Boba and Grogu, they're both kind of outsiders to the cultures that they were brought into. Grogu is a Jedi, or at least a former Jedi, and then you've got Boba, who is this clone. So neither of them are Mandalorians, neither of them are foundlings, but nonetheless, through circumstance, they find themselves intersecting with these two Mandalorian father figures. And then, of course, both examples, both the Fetts and then with Din and Grogu, are examples of what you could call either found families or even forged families. And actually, another interesting little point of similarity is that in both instances, both fathers got their respective children through their jobs. So Jango got Boba in the course of acting as a template for the clone army for Count Dooku, and then Din got Grogu through fulfilling the bounty issued by the Imperial Remnant. So another little point of parallel there. And we see this theme of family and parents and children coming through this episode in some more overt ways. So even though Boba isn't himself a Mandalorian, the armor serves as this kind of material connection to his father. It forms a part of Jango's legacy, and that's the reason why Boba is so eager to get it back. So Jango is a kind of looming figure, and that father-son relationship is a kind of looming dynamic in this episode. And then ultimately, Din recognizes Boba's claim to the armor as valid by virtue of that familial bond that Jango and Boba have. So in that episode, that whole parent-child dynamic is a really, really big factor, even though it's not something that is super overt or something that's super on the surface. It's acting there with Jango and Boba and with Din and Grogu serving as these kind of mirrors to one another. And then in the next episode, we see again that deepening of the relationship and the evolving relationship between Din and Grogu and the two of them coming closer as parent and child. On the one hand, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, you've got Din breaking his code for the sake of his son. He takes off his helmet in the presence of others. And then you get that phenomenal scene at the very end where Din makes contact with Moff Gideon and he is throwing Moff Gideon's words back at him. And he says, "He means more to me than you will ever know." And I think that is the moment in which we really see Din embracing his fatherhood unreservedly. Like, he has come to fully accept Grogu's importance in his life and his bond with Grogu. But then, as we know, in the season finale, Din ultimately makes the difficult decision to give Grogu up to Luke. And I think in what is a very fatherly move, in the sense that he is ultimately looking out for the best interest of his son, of Grogu, and he is doing the thing that he thinks is best for Grogu as opposed to the thing that he would want for himself. And I think that's a very parent and fatherly move, to privilege the interests of your child over your own interests and your own good. So we see Din removing his helmet again so that they can actually look at each other face to face. And you get that very intimate moment there just before Grogu goes to Luke, you know, where he tells him, "Hey, go on. That's who you belong with. He's one of your kind. I'll see you again. I promise. Don't be afraid." So what we see in the second season of The Mandalorian, and what is arguably the most important area of growth for Din Djarin, is he really comes to accept and understand that he is a father to Grogu in a way that he didn't at the end of season one, despite the armor telling him, "You are as Grogu's father." We really see through all of these different interactions that happen over the course of the second season, particularly with Frog Lady, and then with Ahsoka, and then with Boba, and then in the mission to Morak, the ways that Din's fatherhood evolves and he kind of grows into that role. So that finishes that motif and that aspect of The Mandalorian. To move on to the third theme of Star Wars storytelling that I think is very, very apparent in this season, and that is confronting darkness. So all throughout Star Wars, our heroes have to face darkness both internally and externally. So very often what we see is there is, on the one hand, an enemy that needs to be defeated, whether you're talking about the Empire, the First Order, Palpatine, Snoke, Vader. But then there is also an inner darkness that also needs to be combated and overcome. And we see this with a lot of our heroes. We see this with Anakin. Anakin, of course, ultimately succumbs to that darkness in the prequels, but then is able to fight it off at the end of the original trilogy to save his son. We see it with Luke. Luke has to deal with it on Dagobah when he goes into the dark side cave. We see it with Ezra, particularly at the beginning of season three of Rebels. We see it with Rey. She confronts that in The Last Jedi and also in The Rise of Skywalker. And our cast of characters in The Mandalorian have to do it as well. Now, the big contrast between The Mandalorian and, for instance, the saga films is we have, as of yet, not seen a dark side user. So we don't have that as the kind of external focal point of darkness. We don't have a Sith or anything like that. But we do have darkness manifesting in all of these other forms. Again, both in an external fashion and then with one character in particular in an internal fashion. So one of the things that season two of The Mandalorian does is it continues on and builds upon a storyline that we see in season one, which is to explore the fallout of the rebellion's victory at Endor, and also to complicate that somewhat. So when we see Return of the Jedi, we see the victory of the Alliance there as an unambiguous good. The bad guys have been defeated, the Death Star has been destroyed, Palpatine's gone, Vader's gone, the good guys have won. But I think something that has been done a lot, particularly in the Disney era of Star Wars, and something that Mandalorian itself contributes to, is really to asking that question about what has been the fallout throughout the galaxy, and how does everyone across the galaxy experience the collapse of the Empire and the rise of the New Republic. And when you take that more macro view, when you step away just from Endor and what's happening there, it becomes a much more murkier and complicated picture. And that's something that The Mandalorian very much tries to paint. And I think this element of storytelling, really to complicate that Alliance victory, is really important to part of what The Mandalorian wants to do. And is important in terms of cementing The Mandalorian as a bridge between the story of the original trilogy on the one hand and the story of the sequel trilogy on the other. So one of the things that Jon Favreau talked about even before season one of The Mandalorian dropped is that one of the things that the show was going to deal with was the rise of the First Order. And I think for the story of Star Wars, it is crucial to understand not just how the First Order arose from a kind of logistical, material perspective, but also why it arose. In other words, what would make the emergence of the First Order welcome, a positive thing for at least some people in the galaxy? And I think both season one and season two of The Mandalorian deal with this to different degrees. Because one of the things that we see in season two is that the demise of the Empire creates these power vacuums in the galaxy that others are ultimately able to exploit. So this is something that we see in the first episode of season two with the Marshal, where Cobb Vanth is telling the story of how he got Boba Fett's armor, and he's talking about how in Mos Pelgo there were all these celebrations the night that the Death Star was destroyed. They're watching that, like, TikTok of the Death Star blowing up. And then basically that very night, the mining collective sweeps in the town and tries to take control and starts shooting up the cantina and killing a bunch of people. So basically, at literally the same time that the events in Return of the Jedi are happening, and we see, you know, Yub Nub, and we see Luke and Lando and Han and Leia all celebrating, in another corner of the galaxy, on Mos Pelgo and Tatooine, they're having a very different experience of the collapse of the Empire. They're seeing what happens when that centralized government is gone. You have these other actors, these other malicious actors, sweeping in to take power. And that's something we also see later on in the season when we get to the episode The Jedi, where we're introduced to the character of Morgan Elsbeth, who is the magistrate at the city of Caladan, where she was a former Imperial weapons magnate, and she kind of sets herself up as this tyrannical ruler of this city. So she is also exploiting this power vacuum left by the Empire, much in the same way that the mining collective did in Mos Pelgo. So that's something that I really, really like in this season. We're starting to learn more about how the collapse of the Empire is experienced in all of these different pockets of the galaxy, and something that we're seeing is that it's not necessarily an unambiguous good for everyone in the galaxy. It really depends on where you are. Another thing that season two does that builds on what we see in season one is that it continues to underscore the fanaticism of the Imperial remnants and just how extreme the remaining adherents to the Empire have become in the years since the Battle of Endor. So what we are seeing in The Mandalorian is that in defeat, the segments of the Empire that still remain, they've become feral. They've become more extreme. Now that the Empire proper has collapsed, the only people who are left behind to manage these remnants are the most fanatical, the most loyal, the most extreme diehard believers in the Empire. And this, I think, is another connective tissue to the First Order. This is something I talked about in the previous episode with McDowell when we were talking about The Force Awakens, how the First Order has this very, very intense, fanatical, extremist perspective, where they are in some ways even more fanatical than the Empire itself. And we can see where the roots of that come from when we look at, for instance, these remnants that were introduced to in The Mandalorian, how those people will end up becoming the kind of predecessors to the people who will be in the First Order. So we get a number of examples of this spread out across the season. So for example, in the episode The Heiress, when Bo-Katan and Din and the other Mandalorians are going to take the Gazanti cruiser, we see the Imperial officers on board the cruiser. The head guy, he makes contact with Moff Gideon to request support, but then Moff Gideon basically says, "Oh, you guys are screwed, I'm not sending backup." And he has that really chilling line where he just tells the guy, "Long live the Empire." And the guy repeats it back, and then he shoots the two pilots. And it's such a chilling line. It's such a chilling moment. On the one hand, there's a bit of a kind of ironic dissonance in the line, because he's saying long live the Empire, but the Empire is dead for all intents and purposes. Yes, you've got these remnants, but like the Empire as we understand it, as this thing that rules the galaxy, doesn't exist. At the same time, that line, and particularly the way that Moff Gideon delivers it, it underscores that in the eyes of the Empire and its agents, everyone and anyone is expendable in service of the cause. Because that is basically what Moff Gideon is conveying when he says, long live the Empire. He is telling them that is a code for them to sacrifice themselves for this greater cause of restoring the Empire. And that is something that we see in other Star Wars media also, the way that the Empire, and then later on in the sequel trilogy, the First Order, has this very expendable attitude that anyone can be tossed aside, and that any kind of solidarity or compassion or camaraderie with other people is highly discouraged. The episode where the fanaticism of the Imperial remnants is really front and center is the penultimate episode of season two, The Believer. In The Believer, we get this added layer of depth to the character of Miggs Mayfeld. When we meet him in season one in The Prisoner, we really meet him as this kind of wise-ass, tough talker, kind of obnoxious, a very kind of superficial character, and we don't think there's much to him. And what we learn when we get him back in season two in The Believer is that this attitude that he projects towards other people is really a mask. And it serves as psychological compensation for his involvement with the Empire. And we see him sort of dealing with that at various points in the episode. So when he and Din are on the Rhydonium transport, he goes on this little soliloquy where he says, "Empire, New Republic, it's all the same to these people." This is when they're driving through that little village. "Invaders on their land is all we are. I'm just saying, somewhere, someone is in this galaxy is ruling and others are being ruled." I remember when I was watching that episode the first time and I heard him say that when he was talking about Empire, New Republic, they're all the same. The first thing I thought immediately was I was thinking back to The Last Jedi and to the character of DJ, where he says something very similar. "Finn, let me learn you something big. It's all a machine, partner. Live free, don't join." And then later in the movie where he says, "They blow you up today, you blow them up tomorrow, it's just business." Very similar attitude between those two. Miggs Mayfeld in that moment is the DJ of The Mandalorian. Now in the case of DJ, we don't know much about his background or his history, so we don't really know where his own attitude is coming from and what sort of experiences, if any, are informing it. In the case of Mayfeld, though, we know where that's coming from. So Mayfeld's cynicism, is pretty clear from the episode, is in part a kind of defense mechanism. So if it is the case, as Mayfeld alleges, that the Empire is really no different from the New Republic, if they're all invaders on their land, and they're all as equally morally dubious or immoral, if that is the case, then it means that he wasn't a bad guy by virtue of being in the Empire. Because basically everyone is the same. Everyone is on the same moral plane. So he himself was no worse than anyone who's in the New Republic. So we can see how that attitude, that cynical attitude of they're all the same, it doesn't matter, that that can function as this kind of defense mechanism and allow him to, as he puts it in the episode, sleep at night in order to not have to dwell on the crimes that he committed as an agent of the Empire. But of course, later on in the episode, he's made to confront that head on when he has a confrontation with his former superior officer, Valen Hess. And what we see in that exchange that happens in the mess hall, we see Mayfeld pressing Hess on the sacrifices that were made at this one particular conflict, Burnin Khan, in the course of the execution of Operation Cinder. Mayfeld points out, an entire city gone within moments, along with everyone in it. We lost our whole division that day. Man, that was like 5,000-10,000 people. And the Valenhaus responds, yep, all heroes of the Empire. And then Mayfeld responds, yeah, and all dead. And that was another moment where I had a TLJ flashback, thinking back to that moment on the Radis between Leia and Poe after the Dreadnought fight, where Poe defends his actions and he says, there were heroes on that mission. And then Leia replies, dead heroes. Similar sort of exchange there. And then Valenhaus a little bit later on says, well, it's a small sacrifice for the greater good, son. So we see that attitude, that same attitude from Long Live the Empire in the Heiress, this notion of everyone is expendable in service of this greater cause. And then Valenhaus says something a little bit after that that is also really significant and connects us back both to season one of The Mandalorian and then forward into the sequel trilogy. And talking about the New Republic, he says, they're eating themselves alive. The New Republic is in complete disarray and we grow stronger. You see, boys, everybody thinks they want freedom, but what they really want is order. And when they realize that, they're going to welcome us back with open arms. And that whole soliloquy there, that mirrors something that we see in the penultimate episode of season one, and that's the client speech to Din Djarin when he's talking about the Mandalorians resisting the Empire, and why did they do that? Look at everything that the Empire provided them. Peace, prosperity, trade, commerce. Look at how things are now. Are things really better after the revolution? It's a similar sort of speech that both of them give. So we get that insight into that mentality about why people would still stick with the Empire, this notion that the Empire brought order, it brought stability. And again, looking forward, it connects to the sequel trilogy, why some people would be supportive of the rise of the First Order, that the First Order is hearkening back to the glory days of the Empire when there was order and security in the galaxy. There's that connective tissue from the original trilogy through The Mandalorian into the sequel trilogy. We're seeing that justification. We're seeing that alternate history getting written in here in The Mandalorian. And then ultimately, what we see with Mayfeld, his arc is kind of complete in this episode where he's able to find a measure of peace by not being in this kind of neutral position, not being like, oh, Empire, New Republic, they're all the same. He ultimately sort of takes a side or takes a stand when he both kills Valen Hess and then ultimately destroys the Rhydonium that is at the base that the Remnant was otherwise going to use. And I think there's something else really interesting about Miggs Mayfeld, and to pull another parallel with season one, which is that Miggs Mayfeld is very much the IG-11 of season two. Think back to season one. We are reintroduced to IG-11 when? In the penultimate episode of season one. So the same point in the story as in season two. And what we see is that with both with Miggs Mayfeld and with IG-11, when they're reintroduced, our main characters initially only see them through the lens of what they once were. So when Din and Kara go to get Queel for their mission, they see IG-11. Din has the immediate reaction of, oh, that's the bounty hunter. That's a killer. That's his first reaction. He sees IG-11 for what he once was. Ditto with Miggs Mayfeld. When Kara goes to the chop fields to pick him up, she mentions that the reason that she's breaking him out is, she says, quote, because you're Imperial. Notice the structure of that sentence. You're Imperial. She's using the present tense, not you were Imperial. You are Imperial. So she's still treating him and looking at him as he once was. And then he immediately responds back to that. He says, hey, that was a long time ago, all right? So he has that immediate visceral reaction saying, I'm not that guy anymore. Just like with IG-11, where the initial reaction is, oh, he's still what he once was. He's still a killer. And then the arc of IG-11 in season one say, oh no, he has actually changed. He has become something else. And he cements that by ultimately self-destructing and saving the gang from the stormtroopers at the end of the season finale. Miggs Mayfeld ultimately proves that by killing Valen Hess and destroying the Rhydonium. And he goes through that arc. And then other people come to see that, oh yeah, we were wrong about him. He's actually changed. So there's that parallelism between season one and season two, between Mayfeld and IG-11. where they go through very similar arcs and evolutions, and the other characters have to go through this process of changing their expectations and the way that they perceive these characters. In addition to seeing the kind of psychology and mentality of these Imperial remnants, another thing that season two builds on from season one is that we start to learn more about the nature of the Imperial remnant's work, and particularly Gideon's remnant. And we see that in particular in the episode The Siege. So Din and Kara and Greef, they go to take out what they think is this Imperial military installation on Navarro. It turns out to actually be an Imperial laboratory, and they come across these disfigured clone bodies in these tanks. And they come across this message from Dr. Pershing where he is reporting on the experiments, and you see all these references to transfusions and to volunteers and to a donor and to M-count, to midichlorians. So we are seeing what was sort of hinted at in the first season, and we kind of assumed where the story was going. We're starting to see this building on this notion of Imperial eugenics, that this Imperial remnant is involved in all of these experiments with cloning and harvesting blood and trying to enhance individuals. We're not totally sure exactly what they're doing yet. And then the other thing that we see in addition to that is we are introduced to these characters of the Dark Troopers. So we're seeing this other work that the remnant has been involved in order to project its power. And there's an interesting line from Dr. Pershing in the season finale when he's explaining to Din and the gang just before they go on to Moff Gideon's cruiser about the Dark Troopers. And he says, quote, "These are third generation design. They are no longer suits. The human inside them was the final weakness to be solved. They're droids." So I think that's that line where he's talking about the human being the final weakness to be solved. I think there's a connection between the Dark Troopers on the one hand and then whatever this eugenic type project is going on with these clones and these transfusions. And this is something that, again, connects what's happening in The Mandalorian to other things that we see in Star Wars, which is we see this continued process of the Empire and Imperials in various ways rejecting, manipulating, or perverting nature. And we see this also at the Empire's height, where you see things like cloning. We're going to see that with Palpatine down the road when you get to Rise of Skywalker. We get stories about resource extraction. That's a big part of the novel A New Dawn. It's something that's a big part of Rebels. And it's also something that we see elsewhere in season two of The Mandalorian, particularly the episode of The Jedi, when we get to Corvus and we see the way that Morgan Elsbeth, through her rule, has kind of devastated and laid waste to the forests of Corvus. So that, again, building on other elements of Star Wars storytelling, we're seeing all the ways that the Empire is trying to bend nature to its own will and trying to bend biology to its own will in service of the greater cause. So those are the examples of the external darkness that our characters are confronting when they're, particularly when they're facing off against the remnants of the Empire. But as I mentioned, there is also an internal darkness. That's also a big part of the story of Star Wars, of confronting darkness. And we see that particularly in the character of Grogu. Now, we've already talked about this a little bit in the previous segment about parents and children when I was talking about the egg eating in The Passenger and the way that that is symbolic of Grogu's potential to do harm if he doesn't have proper training and rearing. One of the things that season two does is we get greater insight into Grogu's past and particularly the trauma that he has endured prior to meeting Din, and we learn about that in The Jedi via Ahsoka. She tells us, quote, "He was raised at the Jedi Temple on Coruscant. Many masters trained him over the years. At the end of the Clone Wars, when the Empire rose to power, he was hidden. Someone took him from the temple. Then his memory becomes dark. He seemed lost, alone." And then, as I talked about a few minutes ago, Ahsoka talking to Din about how Grogu's attachments to him make him vulnerable to turning to the dark side. So we see hints of this trauma that Grogu has himself endured and suffered through by virtue of being at the Jedi Temple and Order 66 and being hidden, and the implication or the hint that maybe some of that trauma may have led to some memory loss. And so we're not really sure what happened to him in the intervening years. And again, this looming potential that Grogu might go down the wrong path. The most poignant moment of this, for me at least, in watching season two, of just the potential for how wrong things can go for Grogu, comes at the end of the episode of The Tragedy, which for my money gives us one of the darkest scenes in all of Star Wars. And that is the scene where Grogu is in his cell on Moff Gideon's cruiser, and we see him tossing the stormtroopers around his cell with the Force. There's something so poignant and emotional, at least for me, watching that scene. I think part of it is what's happening. Some of it is also a function of Ludwig Göransson's score in that moment. One of the tropes about Star Wars is that titles often have multiple meanings, that they have more meaning than just one. And I think this is especially true for this episode, The Tragedy. I think the tragedy that is being referred to in that title is not just Grogu's kidnapping, although that is the main one. I think what we also see in that last scene, and what another aspect of this episode that is tragic, is we're seeing a child bending under the weight of the trauma he's endured. He's gone through all the stuff that we don't know much about, that, but that Ahsoka has hinted about. Now he's going through more, where he's being taken away from his father to whom he has a strong balance. And we've seen that scene where he's in that cell and he's tossing around those stormtroopers. We're seeing him bending and buckling to that trauma. We're seeing him giving into it and tapping into some of that dark side, some of that fear, that hate, that anger. And it's for that reason that I think that scene is so, so powerful and so, so important, and may potentially foreshadow future character development for Grogu in later seasons of The Mandalorian. So confronting darkness, that's a big aspect of season two, and again, is one of these central Star Wars themes, one of these linkages connecting The Mandalorian to this larger Star Wars storytelling that we see and giving us a quintessentially Star Wars story. So now we move into the fourth theme that I want to use to talk about The Mandalorian Season 2, which is truths from a certain point of view. This is a particularly big aspect of Star Wars. We see this most famously in the original trilogy, where Ben initially tells Luke that Darth Vader betrayed and murdered his father, and then in Return of the Jedi, Obi-Wan tells him, "You'll find many of the truths we cling to will depend greatly on our point of view." And so he's basically insisting that he was telling Luke the truth the whole time. Now, we can use the lens of truths from a certain point of view and apply it to the story of season two itself. So we can look at something like the Heiress and talk about how Din, who's lived under this one particular truth of the Mandalorian way, is forced through the character of Bo-Katan to confront these other truths about different ways that Mandalorians live and different creeds that Mandalorians abide by. Instead, I want to use this theme, this motif, and apply it to the, apologies for using this word, discourse around Mandalorian Season 2. So Season 2 has brought to the fore two major conversations within Star Wars fandom that have arguably in a lot of ways defined the Disney era of Star Wars. And that is this debate about big versus small galaxy. I alluded to that towards the beginning of the episode. And then also this debate about new and original storytelling versus established content. In some ways, you could make the case that these are two sides of the same coin. Now, one of the major lines of criticism of season two is that the show in its first season started off as something new, original, and different. We met all these characters that we'd never seen before. But that now going into its second season and potentially going into third and fourth season beyond, that is now leaning too much on already existing characters. And as a consequence, is making the world smaller. And then in doing so is, quote unquote, playing it safe. I would submit, however, and I've already alluded to this a little bit in the beginning of the episode when I was talking about cameos initially, but now I want to build on this point. I think the extent to which that is true, the extent to which the narrative story-making decisions that were made in Mandalorian Season 2 and the characters are brought in, the extent to which that constitutes making the world smaller, playing it safe, I think really depends on your point of view as a Star Wars consumer. And I think if anything, the response to season two has highlighted the divide between what I would call the 1% and the 99% in Star Wars fandom. Now, I'm not using these numbers or percentages in any sense literally. I'm using them as a kind of figure of speech to draw a contrast between diehard Star Wars fans, the 1%, and then the 99%, aka the casual fans. There's a line from the novel Lost Stars that I really, really like, and that I think can be useful in terms of informing the way that we talk about and evaluate not just the narrative decisions that were made in season two of The Mandalorian, but any subsequent narrative decisions that get made in later seasons. And it's this line that Sienna reuses, which is, "Look through my eyes." I think a useful intellectual exercise for those of us who belong in the 1% of Star Wars fandom is to ask ourselves, what does The Mandalorian look like for Star Wars' 99%? And I would submit that for many, if not the majority of Star Wars fans, particularly for those in the 99%, season two did exactly what a lot of people in the 1% wanted and what a lot of people in the 1% insisted didn't happen. And that is, it introduced them to new stories and to new characters. So on the one hand, I talked about this towards the beginning of the episode, I think bringing in characters like a Bo-Katan, like an Ahsoka, like a Luke, can help to make the world of The Mandalorian bigger, not smaller, and I would say that effect is particularly compounded if you're a more casual Star Wars fan, because it does have this effect of elevating the stakes of Din's quest and of making him this player in these major galactic events. More importantly, though, for those casual fans, for those in that 99%, and again, I'm using 99% not in a literal sense, but in a figurative sense, someone like a Bo-Katan, someone like an Ahsoka, is, for all intents and purposes, a new character. Now, we can say that's not technically true, and we would be technically right. We can point to Clone Wars and Rebels and say they have these whole established storylines there. But again, for that casual fan who is just coming at it from having watched the movies and is watching The Mandalorian, there is functionally no difference between Bo-Katan, the character who made the jump from animation, and Bo-Katan, the character who was invented whole cloth for The Mandalorian. Those are pretty much the same character. Now, the hope is that, and there's been some data that maybe suggests this has happened, that The Mandalorian is going to encourage some of those in the 99%, some of those casual fans, to go check out the animated series, to go watch some Clone Wars, to go watch some Rebels. And if they do that, their understanding of Star Wars will get bigger. The galaxy will get bigger for them. So I think Mandalorian is doing that work that a lot of us in the 1% wanted to do. It is making it bigger for people. At the same time, I think, again, if we adopt that perspective of the 99%, from the perspective of the 1%, I think bringing in a lot of these characters, bringing in a Bo-Katan, bringing in an Ahsoka, reads as playing it safe, because you're not creating new, different, original characters, you're just leaning on these established tentpole characters. But I think, again, if we do the look through my eyes, if we look from the 99%, I think it actually carries some amount of storytelling risk. So there is the risk, for instance, that casual fans might not feel invested in these recurring characters if they don't know these pre-established storylines. So if you take somebody like Ahsoka Tano, on the one hand, there is in Star Wars a lot of storytelling around Ahsoka Tano. She's a big character in Clone Wars. She plays a role in Rebels. We have the Ahsoka novel. But for many fans, again, for a lot of those people in the 99%, for many of those fans, The Mandalorian is the beginning, middle, and end of her journey. If they don't go back to watch Rebels and Clone Wars, if they don't stick around to watch the Ahsoka spin-off show, the Jedi is all they know about Ahsoka Tano. That is the full extent of their knowledge of this character. And if that is the case, there is a risk that she won't land, that you throw in this character, you throw in this quote-unquote new Jedi, and people who are watching that episode may not latch onto her, may not understand why she's important or why she's showing up in The Mandalorian and the significance of that, and may not feel invested enough to go watch a Clone Wars, to go watch a Rebels. Or they might feel as though they've lost the plot, that they can't really watch this because it's not made for them. Similarly, with somebody like a Bo-Katan, if you're introducing that character and you're a casual fan who doesn't know her story in Clone Wars and Rebels, you might not particularly care about Bo-Katan's quest to get the Darksaber. Now, that's something that Season 3 might flesh out and that problem will get solved. But it's possible that it may not, and you'll just be like, well, why do I care if the ginger lady has this magic sword? We do in the 1% because we watch Clone Wars and Rebels. But for that 99%er, throwing in a character like Bo-Katan, there's a certain amount of risk that a casual fan is not going to fully appreciate the stakes of the story because they don't have that requisite background knowledge and they don't have that investment in the character. They're not bringing that in from having watched her in animation. So the stuff that to a lot of us reads as playing it safe, I think there are narrative risks in there. And I think we should recognize that. I think we should look it through the eyes of those casual fans. That bringing in those characters carries the potential that you're going to lose some people. Now, no character cameo has more inflamed this conversation about new versus old in Star Wars than Luke Skywalker. For a lot of people in the 1% of Star Wars fandom, Luke showing up in the rescue was the ultimate example of smallness and playing it safe. Here we go again. Another Skywalker. The Skywalkers are this kind of gravity well of Star Wars, sucking everybody in towards them. But again, I think if we do this intellectual exercise, if we adopt the perspective of the 99%, I think there is a clearer rationale for why Luke makes a good amount of narrative sense in The Mandalorian. And I want to sort of walk through that case. Now, before I do, I want to preface this by saying that this isn't a section called Truths from a Certain Point of View. I know there's a lot of people who didn't want Luke to be there, and I don't want this argument to come across as saying, well, anybody who is not happy about Luke being there is dumb and I'm right and this is the way that you need to see it. I'm just presenting my own particular perspective. Take it or leave it. Do what you will with it. So I think first things first, when we look at the arc of Season 2, I think for me at least, the way that I saw it, a Jedi needed to show up in the Season 2 finale. The reason is that the search for the Jedi was the main arc of Season 2. It was the driving plot device across the entire season. And we needed some sort of resolution to that so that it wasn't an open question going into Season 3. Because if there wasn't a Jedi who showed up, then we would essentially start Season 3 in the same spot narratively that we started Season 2, which is we're looking for a Jedi. Will we find one? Will Grogu go with them? We'd be asking the same questions and telling the same story in Season 3 as we did in Season 2. So I think we needed that narrative bow on the search storyline so that Season 3 could go and explore the fallout of a Jedi showing up and could take the story in different narrative directions. Now, that didn't necessarily mean that Grogu had to go with whatever Jedi showed up, but somebody still needed to show up so that he could actually make that decision. So I think someone did need to show up in the Season 2 finale. I think there was a lot of narrative sense to do that. So if we stipulate that that's the case, that there's a strong case for somebody to show up in the finale, the question then becomes, which Jedi shows up? And there's three options. First option is the quote-unquote obvious option, the option that they went with, and that's Luke Skywalker. Second option is another canon Jedi who we would presume to be alive and active in this time period. So that's your Cal Kestis. That's your Ezra Bridger. Quinlan Vos, I suppose. Third route is brand new Jedi. So that could be either recanonizing someone from Legends, or it could just be inventing someone whole cloth for The Mandalorian and they show up in the finale. I would submit, again, from my perspective, from my point of view, that of these three options, Luke is the best. So let me explain why I think so. First, let's take a look at that second option, which is the existing canon Jedi. And here I'm particularly interested in the two that a lot of people wanted to show up and thought might show up, and that's Cal Kestis and Ezra Bridger. Now, if you pick one of those two to show up, one of the effects that it has on those characters is that it establishes what you might call a narrative anchor, which is say that it fixes them in a particular place in the timeline to which they must invariably reach. That has the effect of constraining any sort of storytelling that you do with them. So any story that you tell about Cal Kestis, if it's Cal Kestis, or Ezra Bridger, if it's Ezra Bridger, must be such that in 9ABY, they are on Gideon's light cruiser to pick up Grogu. And that has implications. So, for instance, if we get a Rebels 2, if we get a Search for Ezra story in any sort of manifestation, we would go into that story already knowing that in 9ABY, Ezra Bridger shows up on Gideon's light cruiser to take Grogu. Ditto with if it'd been Cal Kestis and we get a Jedi Fallen Order 2. We know whatever happens in that story. Cal Kestis in 9ABY would be on Gideon's light cruiser to pick up Grogu. Now, having that kind of fixed point, having a narrative anchor, isn't necessarily incompatible with telling earlier compelling stories. As an example, I would submit Season 7 of The Clone Wars. We got a Siege of Mandalore story that was very, very good and very, very emotional. Even though we knew that Ahsoka was making it out and Rex was making it out because we already had Rebels. So it's not the case that if you got that narrative anchor with Ezra or Cal, you couldn't tell a good Rebels 2 story or a good Jedi Fallen Order 2 story. However, it does limit your options. It does act as a constraint. So, as an example, I would submit the prequels. So, one of the things that I think is clear when you look at the prequels, and I am by no means a prequels hater by any stretch, is that it was clear that they had these narrative anchors that they had to reach. And that is something that you could tell in some of the storytelling choices. And I would say it's particularly apparent in Revenge of the Sith, where it was like, okay, well, we've got A New Hope, and we got to get all of these characters into their particular spots in A New Hope. And how can we do that in the course of one movie? And you can imagine a world in which the original trilogy didn't exist, and you just had the prequel trilogy first. You can imagine a Revenge of the Sith that looks quite different from the Revenge of the Sith that we got. Again, I like the Revenge of the Sith that we got, but you can imagine where those anchors don't exist, the story going in a whole bunch of different directions that it couldn't go in our current reality because you've got the original trilogy there acting as an anchor. So you get that constraint there, and if you can avoid putting any of those kind of constraints from a storytelling perspective, avoid them. Like, as somebody who is a big fan of Rebels and who wants to see some sort of Rebels 2 story, Search for Ezra story, I personally am glad that we don't have the Mandalorian there being like, okay, well, whatever happens in this story, I know Ezra shows up in 9ABY on Gideon's light cruiser. Now we're in a world in which the Search for Ezra story could go in a whole bunch of directions and is not constrained by that particular anchor. And I'm sure there are a lot of Jedi Fallen Order fans who feel the same way about Cal Kestis. With somebody like Luke, that narrative anchor concern is not as prominent because we already have the sequel trilogy, we know how Luke's story, and we're now just kind of backfilling and telling, well, what happened in between the time of Return of the Jedi and the sequel trilogy. So we're not super concerned about setting up narrative anchors for him because we already know where his story goes. So that's a reason for, let's say, not using a Cal Kestis or not using an Ezra Bridger. But what about another canon Jedi where you don't have those same sort of stakes? Let's say like a Quinlan Vos. We're not really expecting future Quinlan Vos storytelling, so why not drop him in? Or what about the third option? Brand new Jedi. Bring in somebody we've never seen before. Maybe they're another Order 66 survivor. Maybe they're someone Luke trained, whatever. What about those options? I think Luke has a particular advantage over those options, either another canon Jedi or the brand new Jedi route, which is that Luke offers a narrative shortcut, which is to say that the audience already knows who Luke is. They know he's a Jedi. They know he's reestablishing the Order. If they've seen the sequel trilogy, they can already infer that going into The Mandalorian. None of that requires explaining to the audience. And that means in turn that the audience knows the stakes of Luke showing up to take Grogu and what that means. So in other words, Luke is a kind of ultimate example of the storytelling line about show, don't tell. You plop Luke in The Mandalorian and you don't have to tell the audience everything. You just have to show Luke and they immediately know, oh, he's a Jedi. He's a good guy. We know he's trying to recreate the Jedi. It's all there just in his personage. Now, that is a narrative shortcut. That is not taking the route of bringing in a character that you then have to build up and explain their motivations and why they're here and what they're going to do with Grogu. But I think the advantage of using a narrative shortcut like a Luke is that you can keep the focus more on Din and Grogu. So there were some fans in the aftermath of the season 2 finale who complained that Luke ended up drawing attention away from Din and Grogu in the final minutes of the episode. But I would make the case, I would submit that the fact that Luke is this narrative shortcut, the fact that you don't have to do a lot of telling, you can just show him, means that of all the options available of what Jedi could show up in the finale, Luke was actually the least likely to draw attention away from Din and Grogu. Now, do I think Luke pulled some attention away from them in that scene? Yes, I do. But I think anyone showing up would have pulled some attention away from them solely by virtue of them showing up. I think any character that you plop in that moment is going to have some of that gravitational effect of attention where people are going to be like, who is this person? Oh, wow, someone showed up. So it's just a matter of who does more of that than someone else. And I think Luke, of the options available, relatively speaking, probably has a little bit less of an effect. And here's why I think that. If you had somebody else show up, if you had an Ezra show up, if you had a Cal show up, if you had a stranger show up, brand new Jedi, it would have immediately raised a whole bunch of questions, particularly for your 99% Star Wars fan, for the casual fan, but also for some of the 1%ers. It would have drawn some of their attention away too, particularly if we got a stranger. Imagine if we had a brand new Jedi. Immediately everyone would be asking themselves, like, who is this person? Are they connected to Luke? Can we trust them? Are they really a Jedi? Where are they going? Where are they going to take Grogu? What's going to happen? We'd be asking all of these questions. And a lot of casual fans would be asking those questions, particularly if they got not just a brand new Jedi, but also an Ezra Bridger or a Cal Kestis or a Quinlan Vos. If they're not familiar with those characters, they're going to be like, who is that person? Again, that's going to be functionally a brand new character for them. And from the perspective of a 1%er for us, we would have had our attention split anyway, particularly if it were like a Cal or an Ezra. Our reaction would be like, oh my God, it's Cal Kestis in The Mandalorian, or oh my God, it's Ezra Bridger in The Mandalorian. So I think the best way to keep narrative attention on Din and Grogu in that particular moment is to not have viewers asking too many questions or having too much speculation in the moment about the Jedi who shows up. And I think of all the options available, Luke raises the fewest such questions in the moment. Because again, so much is baked in with the character of Luke Skywalker. And because of that, it allows us to put more focus on Din and Grogu. Does he take some attention away? Sure he does. Would Cal Kestis take away some attention if he showed up? Sure he would. Would Ezra do it? Sure he would. Would a brand new Jedi? Sure he would. But I think because Luke has so much baked into him, I think actually he's a good option in that regard. Like, there's not a lot of questions that you get asked. There's not a lot you're left wondering because it's pretty cut and dry in that moment. And you can really focus on what is the significance of Din and Grogu. Because again, we're not that concerned about who the Jedi is. We're concerned about who the Jedi is and what they're doing insofar as it matters to Din and Grogu, who are the beating heart of the story. So we don't want to ask too many questions about this Jedi and have too much wondering. We don't want the story to focus away from Din and Grogu and towards, well, who is this Jedi and what are they doing and what's their story? We want that focus on Din and Grogu. So if it is Luke, we can be like, okay, it's Luke. We know what Luke is doing. We don't have to linger on that too much. Versus if it is a Quinlan Vos, if it is brand new Jedi X, we have to do a lot of backfilling in the show to explain who they are and why they showed up and what they're doing. And that's going to take away from Din Djarin. It's going to take away from Grogu. In a similar vein, to build off that, I think Luke also offers cut and dry emotional stakes for the 99% in particular. With Luke, you know how and why it matters that he shows up. You know how and why it matters that he's taking Grogu and going to train to be a Jedi. And it elevates the quest as a whole because now you know, oh wow, the stakes of this were that we had to get this kid to Luke Skywalker. Versus if it had been Cal Kestis, if it had been Ezra Bridger, if it had been a stranger, I think for a lot of particularly casual fans, I think the season 2 finale would have been a little hollow because you'd be leaving this question like, okay, well, Grogu's gone, and he's gone with this person who I don't really know. And it's like, why does it matter that we got Grogu to this person I've never heard of? What were the stakes? There would be that lingering question. Versus with Luke, it's really clear why it matters. It's right there. You don't have to tell it. You just have to show Luke. And I think going back again to this conversation about risk-taking and playing it safe, I think the decision to split up Din and Grogu in the finale, I think represents a narrative risk. Because the Mandalorian has now spent two seasons building up this relationship between Din and Grogu, making that the beating heart of the show. And now you're pulling these two characters apart, and it leaves this question about what is this show without the two of them at its center? We're presuming that they're going to get reunited at some point, but until that happens, there is that open question. So if we're going to talk about risk-taking and playing it safe, we have to factor in that they did not go with the safe move in the finale. The safe move would have been to keep Grogu with Din. But they did not go that route. They went the narrative riskier route. And there is the risk that you're going to lose people who are going to be like, I'm really just here for Grogu and I don't care all that much about Din Djarin. So I think that's something also that we need to factor in. So all of this is to say, to step out from the Mandalorian itself and to look at the larger tapestry, if you will, of Star Wars, I think that particularly for us in the 1% of Star Wars fandom, as Disney Star Wars grows, and now we've gotten this announcement of all of these brand new shows and movies that we're going to be getting in the next couple of years, I think it is imperative to not lose sight of the 99%. I think it is really important to strike a balance between expanding the galaxy and the universe, creating new characters, bringing in these pulls from the animated shows, from the video games, from the books, but then also giving something to the 99%, giving the things that the casual fans will know and love as a way to bring them in and keep them invested in the story. Season 2 of The Mandalorian gave a lot to us 1%ers. Season 2 opened with Cobb Vanth. We had an entire episode dedicated to Cobb Vanth, who was a third-tier book character who was not even a main character in the book. He was in some aside chapters that you could have skipped reading Aftermath and you wouldn't have lost any of the plot. And we got a whole episode of The Mandalorian dedicated to him. I would submit Bo-Katan and Ahsoka count. I think they count as concessions of the 1%. I know you want to tell me that they don't count, but I'm going to insist that they count. Because there's a lot of people who haven't watched the animated shows, and there's a lot of people for whom these are, for all intents and purposes, new characters. And there's so many other new forms of storytelling that we're getting in Star Wars, whether it's in the books, whether it's in the comics, the High Republic that is now going to be delving into a brand new period in Star Wars history. So I think maintaining that balance is key. Yes, new and original is good. Yes, doing stuff different is good. But there's got to be concessions towards what's established. Some of that's got to be brought in because we don't want a Star Wars that just caters to the 1%. We want a Star Wars that caters to the 100%, that gives everybody something that they can feel invested in and something that they can enjoy and that nobody feels left out. I want to close out this discussion of The Mandalorian Season 2 by doing some speculating, some running down of wish lists for Season 3. So, as I just talked about a few minutes ago, I think it is very likely that Din and Grogu will be reunited in some fashion at some point in the show, but I don't think it's going to happen immediately, and I don't really want it to happen immediately. I think we do need some distance between the two characters. I think Din needs some fleshing out, separate and apart from Grogu, and it's quite possible that Grogu may need some fleshing out, separate and apart from Din. So if they are reunited, if it does happen in Season 3, I'm hoping that it's going to happen at a midpoint or even at the very end of Season 3. I do want the story to linger on Din some more so we can learn a little bit more about maybe his past, about what he's up to, and get deeper into his character. I think one of the most interesting things that the end of Season 2 sets up, and one thing that's important to note about the Season 2 finale is that it's a lot more ambiguous than the Season 1 finale was. So when Season 1 ended, it was pretty clear what Season 2 was going to go about, because we had already the quest about, we got to bring Grogu to the Jedi. At the end of Season 2, it's much more open, and the stories could go in a lot of different directions. One direction that I'm hoping it is going to go in, and I think it's laid the groundwork for that, is the fate of the Darksaber and what's going to happen with it and who will ultimately come to possess it when the dust settles. The season 2 finale, I think, set up a really interesting tension internally for the character of Bo-Katan. Because in both the times that we see her in season 2, we saw her preaching the need for Mandalorian unity and solidarity. But now that Din possesses the Darksaber, it will now force a conflict within her between her desire to rule Mandalore, which, as far as she understands it, requires her to have the Darksaber, and her desire to maintain that solidarity. Because at this point, in order for her to get the Darksaber, she's got to duel and defeat Din Djarin, which would break that notion of unity. So now it's this question of which route is Bo-Katan going to go down? Is she going to go to get the sword, or is she going to relinquish that in the name of unity and solidarity? And I think what's interesting now, what this season in particular has done, building on what season 1 did and then what Rebels and Clone Wars did, is that it's very clear now that the Darksaber is part of this pantheon of sought-after objects in literature. It is now in the status of an Elder Wand from Harry Potter, or the One Ring from The Lord of the Rings, or the Iron Throne in Game of Thrones. And what we see in all of those stories, in Harry Potter, in Lord of the Rings, in Game of Thrones, is that the initial quest with these objects centers on getting the object to the quote-unquote right person. So, for instance, in Lord of the Rings, when Frodo gets the ring from Bilbo, the first thing he tries to do is he tries to hand the ring off to Gandalf. In the book and the initial part of the quest, it's initially offered to Tom Bombadil, who the ring has no effect on. In Game of Thrones, we see this whole fight for the Iron Throne, and the question is, like, who's going to sit on the Iron Throne? And then in Harry Potter, we see Dumbledore winning the Elder Wand from Grindelwald. So initially, the story started about finding, like, who is the best person to be the steward of this object? But then ultimately, what the moral of the story becomes is that actually no one should possess these objects. That they are, in fact, inherently corrupting, and that the pursuit of them is inherently corrupting. So again, to go back to Lord of the Rings, when Frodo offers Gandalf the ring, what does Gandalf say? He says, "Understand, Frodo, I would use this ring from the desire to do good, but through me, it would wield a power too great and terrible to imagine." And we see in the films, we see Boromir initially, he wants the ring to use it against Sauron. Faramir wants the ring to use it against Sauron. But the ultimate conclusion is that nobody should have the ring. The ring needs to be destroyed. Nobody can wield it for good. That it is inherently corruptive and corrosive. And that is the lesson of Gollum. That's why he is in the story. He is meant to illustrate this. We see this in Harry Potter also. Harry gains the Elder Wand at the end of Deathly Hallows, but then he ultimately relinquishes it. In the book, he stashes it in Dumbledore's office so that when he dies a natural death, its power will be broken. In the movies, he snaps it in half. And then, of course, in Game of Thrones, the Iron Throne is ultimately destroyed and Westeros adopts a different style of government. So my hope is that the Mandalorian, building on the example set by the ring, by the Elder Wand, by the Iron Throne, is going to deconstruct the Darksaber. So my hope is that the story is not going to be just a story about who gets the Darksaber, who deserves to rule. It can start that way. That's totally fine. I have no problem with that. But I hope that it ends at a different point. So where I hope that the story ultimately goes is that I hope it goes to Bo realizing that she doesn't need the Darksaber to rule. That ultimately it is her character and her commitment to her people that make her the best ruler for Mandalore, as opposed to whether or not she wields this magic sword. And I hope that Din comes to realize that having the sword, the mere fact that he won it from Moff Gideon, doesn't automatically entitle him to leadership, that he doesn't have the skills and the history that Bo-Katan has, and that he should ultimately yield to her as the rightful ruler, as opposed to it being him. And my hope is that by the end of The Mandalorian, that we will get a kind of Iron Throne moment where somebody destroys the Darksaber. I would love to see that. And I would love to see Bo-Katan following in the steps of her sister Satine and basically saying, like, well, the old ways have not worked for our people. It's only led to death and destruction and suffering. I am going to carve a new path. We are leaving the tradition of the Darksaber behind, and we're going to go in a new direction, and this is going to be better for our people. I would really, really love to see that. One final point that I want to make about Season 3 and where the story of The Mandalorian can go is I think there's something to be gained out of comparing The Mandalorian to another show that is also running now, and that is Star Trek Discovery. Now, I apologize in advance to anyone listening who has not watched Star Trek Discovery. The next few minutes, you may have no idea what I'm talking about. But I think there is a useful parallel between these two shows, and I think offers something to chew on when we think about where The Mandalorian can go. So Star Trek Discovery is a show that, in a lot of ways, like The Mandalorian, is adjacent to and kind of leans on the established canon of Star Trek. It does so particularly in its first two seasons, where the show initially starts off about a decade or so before the events of Star Trek, the original series, and we see some of that intersecting in the story of the Discovery, even though it's largely new characters. So we get, for instance, Spock is a big part of Season 2. Our main character, Michael Burnham, is related to him. Christopher Pike is a big part of Season 2. The Enterprise is a big part of Season 2. So you have, much like The Mandalorian, you have in Star Trek Discovery, a show that, on the one hand, gives you these new characters and gives you new adventures of them, but is also relying upon and drawing upon these established elements of the canon and established characters and pulling them in and connecting its story to the larger story of Star Trek. But what's interesting about Star Trek Discovery is that in its third season, and I'm not going to say how this happens because I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who is watching or might want to watch the show, which is that in its third season, Discovery has gone in a really, really different direction. It's in a lot of ways kind of upset the apple cart and is telling a story quite unlike what is in its first two seasons. And I think for The Mandalorian doesn't have quite the same amount of space to do it to an as extreme degree as Discovery does. But I think particularly now that, as I mentioned before, now that Din and Grogu are apart, at least for a time, I think there is that space for Favreau and Filoni to go into Season 3, much like Discovery went into Season 3, and basically say, we're going to give a show that in important ways feels really different from what is in the first two seasons. I think in particular, I'm not really sure how viable the side quest model of storytelling is anymore for Season 3 of The Mandalorian now that we don't have this quest. It's possible it could still get adapted in some different fashion towards some different ends. It could also feel forced if it does that. So I think that could get cast by the wayside. I think there's a lot of potential in Season 3 for us to get us something that doesn't really look like the first two seasons, in the same ways that for Discovery took this hard left turn and is now giving us a third season that doesn't really look anything like its first two seasons. So that is my hope, ultimately. My hope is that, even though I spent a good chunk of this episode defending a lot of the narrative decisions in Season 2 and defending bringing in some of these returning characters and leaning on some of this established canon, I do think there is the opportunity, should the creators choose to take it, to move the story in some radically different directions and build on in some really interesting ways on the foundation that they've already laid in the first two seasons. So that concludes my discussion and look back at The Mandalorian Season 2. I hope you enjoyed that. Hope you got something out of it. Hope it added to your perspective, changed your perspective, whatever it did. So what to expect on the next episode? Episode 13 drops on January 17th. I already mentioned at the beginning of this episode that episode 13 will also be Mandalorian themed. But it's not going to be at all like this episode was, and it's probably not going to be like anything else you will hear anywhere else. So beginning with the Clone Wars and going into Rebels and now with The Mandalorian, we've gotten to learn a lot about Mandalorian history, society, and culture. And it's arguably one of the most fleshed out worlds in Star Wars. I think we know more about Mandalore and Mandalorians than we know about just about any other people in Star Wars. And there's a couple of big threads running through the story of the Mandalorian people, whether you're talking about Clone Wars, whether you're talking about Rebels, whether you're talking about the Mandalorian. You've got things like Civil War invasion, culture clashes, factionalism, diaspora, all of which have real-world analogs, and all of which have a particular resonance with my own life. So something that you almost certainly do not know about me, because I've not mentioned on the show, so how else would you know about it, is that I am, or was, depending on how you want to put it, a refugee. I was born in Bosnia, in southeastern Europe, and my parents and I fled the country in the early 1990s after a war broke out in what was then the country of Yugoslavia. So, on episode 13, I will tell my story and the story of where I come from through the lens of Mandalore and the Mandalorians, and talk about the ways in which I've been able to relate to some of what we've seen in Star Wars around the Mandalorians, particularly in Mandalorian Season 2. There's been a lot of resonances there that I'm super excited to get into. So that's going to be a really special episode and is one that you definitely don't want to miss. Until then, make sure you're subscribed to the show. Rate and review the show if you're able to do so. If you're not already following the show on Twitter, do so at A Larger View Pod. You can also follow me on Twitter at DMondum. And until next time, look for the Force, and you will always find me.